His long silence was alleviated only by the moans of the kneeling priests. "I have spoken to you about this before," he said at last. Anubis did not reply. "It is not so much the messiness of your compulsions that offend me," the god continued, allowing anger to creep into his voice for the first time. "All artists have their quirks, and I consider you to be an artist. But your methodology displeases me. You have consistently advertised your peculiar talents in a way that may eventually prove your undoing. They tested you repeatedly in those institutions, you know. Some day soon, even the plodding Australian police will make some connection there. But most unfortunate of all, you are advertising by your little signatures, however obliquely, something that is far more important to me than you are. I do not know what you think you know of my work, but the Sangreal is not a joke for you to snigger at." The god rose to his feet, and for a moment allowed a hint of something larger to smear itself around him, a blurring, lightning-charged shadow. His voice rumbled like a summer storm.
"Do not misunderstand me. If you compromise my project, I will deal with you swiftly and finally. If such a situation comes to pass, whatever protections you think you have will blow away like straws in a hurricane."
He allowed himself to settle back into his throne. "Otherwise, I am pleased with you, and it hurts me to upbraid you. Do not allow this to happen again. Find a less idiosyncratic way to slake your compulsions. If you please me, you will find that there are rewards you cannot even imagine. I do not exaggerate. Am I understood?" The jackal head wagged as if its owner were exhausted. The god looked for a hint of defiance, but saw only fear and resignation. "Good," he said. "Then our audience is finished. I look forward to your next progress report on the Sky God Project. Next week?" Anubis nodded, but did not look up. The god crossed his arms, and Death's messenger disappeared. Osiris sighed. The old, old man inside the god was weary. The interview with his underling hadn't gone too badly, but now it was time to talk to the Dark One, the other, the one creature in all the world that he feared. Work, 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 and none of it pleasant anymore. Only the Grail could be worth such heartache, such suffering. Death cursed sourly and got on with it. Chapter 15. Friends in High Places. Netfeed News. 6 powers sign Antarctica Pact. Visual: metal wreckage scattered across ice floe. VO: the twisted wreckage of fighter jets will remain as a mute reminder of the short-lived but disastrous Antarctic conflict. Representatives of the 6 powers whose disagreement over mineral rights began the conflict met in Zurich to sign a treaty re-establishing Antarctica as an international territory. She met Khabu on the bus at Pinetown Station. He sprang from his seat when he saw her, as though she had fainted in the aisle instead of merely stopping to take a breath after climbing the steps. "Are you all right?" She gestured for him to sit, then slid into the seat beside him.
"I'm well, just a little short of breath. I haven't been getting around much lately."
He frowned. "I would have come to meet you."
"I know. That's why I wouldn't let you. You've been all the way out to my flat block 3 times now since I had my... since I got ill. All I had to do was catch a local bus to get here. 10 minutes.
Khabu, of course, had probably been on the bus almost an hour already. The service from Chesterville was not particularly fast.
"I am worried for you. You have been very poorly."
His concerned look was almost stern, as though she were a child playing in a dangerous place. She laughed.
"I told you it wasn't a full-blown heart attack, just a temporary arrhythmia. I'm okay now."
Rini didn't want anyone worrying over her, even Khabu. It made her feel weak, and she didn't trust weakness. She was also growing uncomfortable about the burden of responsibility she had dropped on her small friend. He had completed his coursework, so he was not losing study time. But what money he had must be running out while she was using up an unconscionable amount of his energies. Only the fact that his safety, too, now seemed compromised had convinced her to drag him along on this errand.
But it was my problems that exposed him to danger in the first place,
she thought miserably.
What are you going to do now that you've finished the course?
She asked.
Are you going to do a graduate program?
A certain melancholy crept over his delicate features. I do not know, Rini. I am thinking. There are things I do not know yet. I told you something of my plans, but I see now that I am far from being ready to make them real.
Also,
his voice dropped conspiratorially. He looked up and down the aisle of the bus as though checking for spies.
Also,
he continued quietly,
I am thinking and thinking of the experience I had when we were in that place.
The rasp of gears changing as the bus cornered was deafening. Rini suppressed a smile. Any eavesdropper would have to be a lip-reader.
If I can help in any way, she said, please tell me. I owe you a lot. I could help you find a grant, maybe.
The bushman shook his head vigorously.
It is not money. It is more difficult than that. I wish it were a city problem. Then I could ask my friends and find a city answer. But in this place where I live now, I must discover the answer to this problem myself.
Now it was Rini's turn to shake her head.
I'm not sure I understand.
Neither am I.
Khabu smiled, banishing his own somber look. But Rini saw his conscious effort, and felt a momentary pang of sadness. Was this what he had learned in Durban, and in the other places where what he called city people lived? To dissemble? To hide his feelings and show a false seeming?
I suppose I should be grateful he's not that good at it, yet.
The bus was climbing an overpass. Khabu was staring out the window and down at the riverine expanse of National Route 3, at the cars packed into it even in mid-morning like termites in a split log. Suddenly uncomfortable with the symptoms of modern life she normally took for granted, Rini turned away to examine their fellow passengers. Most of them were older black women, heading for Kloof and the other wealthy northeastern suburbs to work as domestics, just as they and their predecessors had for decades, both before and after liberation. The chubby woman nearest her, head wrapped in a traditional but now slightly old-fashioned headscarf, wore a look that someone less familiar with it than Rini would have called blank. It was not hard to see how white South Africans in the old apartheid days, facing that expressionless stare, would have projected onto it any emotions they wished. Sullenness, stupidity, even the potential for murderous violence. But Rini had grown up around such women, and knew that the expression was a mask that they wore like a uniform. At home, or in the shebeen or tea shop, they would smile and laugh easily, but working for the volatile whites, it had always been easier to show nothing. If you showed nothing, the white boss could not take offense, or feel pity, or, as was sometimes worse, presume to a friendship that could never really exist under such inequality. Rini had white colleagues at the Poly, and some she even socialized with after work. But as Pinetown had become a mixed neighborhood, the whites that could afford to had moved out to places like Kloof and the Berea Ridgetop, always to the high places, as if their black neighbors and co-workers were not individuals, but part of some vast dark tide drowning the lowlands. If institutionalized racism was gone, the dividing wall of money was as high as it had ever been. There were blacks in all industries now, and at all levels, and blacks had held most of the top jobs in government since the liberation. But South Africa had never quite climbed out of its third-world hole, and the 21st century had not been any kinder to Africa than had the 20th. Most blacks were still poor, and most whites, for whom the transition to black rule had not been anywhere near as bad as they had feared, were not. As she looked around, Rini's gaze was arrested by a young man a few seats behind her. Despite the overcast day, he was wearing sunglasses. He had been watching her. But when his eyes, or his lenses, met her stare, he turned quickly to look out the window. She felt a moment of reflexive fear, but then she saw the shunt at the base of his skull, just peeping from beneath his cap, and understood. She turned away, clutching her bag a little tighter to her lap. After a moment she cautiously turned to look again. The charge head was still staring out the window, fingers jittering on the seat back in front of him. His clothes were wrinkled and sweat-stained at the armpits. The Nuracanula was a township job, and the insertion had been cheap and dirty. She could see a gleam of suppuration around the edge of the plastic. A slight pressure on her leg made her jump. Habu raised his eyes, questioning.
"It's nothing," she said. "I'll tell you later."
She shook her head. There had been a charge pit in one of the flats when she and Stephen and her father had first moved in, and she had more than once encountered its zombie denizens in the stairwell. They were generally harmless. Extended use of charge gear with its high-speed strobing and infrasound tended to make a person uncoordinated and passive, but she had never been comfortable around them, however loopy and withdrawn they seemed. She had been violently pawed on a bus when she was a student by a man who clearly wasn't seeing her at all, but was reacting to some unimaginable vision induced by pounding his brain into jelly, and afterward she had never been able to laugh at charge heads the way her friends did. In fact, they had turned out not to be so harmless after all, but the police didn't seem capable of doing much, so after several of the older residents had been robbed and some of the flats had been burglarized, a vigilante group, her father had been part of it, had taken cudgels and cricket bats and kicked down the door. The skinny creatures inside had not put up much of a fight, but heads were still split, and ribs were cracked. Rini had seen the charge heads in nightmares for months after, tumbling down the stairs in slow motion, flapping their arms like drowning men, and making hooting noises that sounded more animal than human. They had been almost incapable of defending themselves, as though this sudden eruption of anger and pain were only a further, if somewhat unsatisfactory, part of the charge. Still in the midst of her idealistic student phase, Rini had been shocked when she discovered that her father and the other men had taken the equipment and gear they found there, cheap Nigerian stuff mostly, and sold it, drinking up the returns over the succeeding week while retelling the story of their victory. As far as she knew, none of the building's robbery victims had ever received a share of the profits. Long Joseph Sulueo and the others had won the prerogative of conquerors, the right to divide the booty. Actually, the effect she had suffered in Mr. J's was not that different from charge, although far more sophisticated. Is that what they'd done? Found some way to hyperpower a charge high? Supercharge it, as it were? Then put in some kind of hypnotic shackle to keep the victims from breaking the loop? Rini? Habu patted her leg again. She shook her head, realizing that she had been staring into space as fixedly as the man with the can in his head.
Sorry. Just thinking about something.
I would like to ask you about the person we are going to see.
She nodded.
I was going to tell you. I just got sidetracked. She used to be a teacher of mine at the University of Natal.
And she taught you, what is your degree called? Virtual engineering?
Weenie laughed.
That's what they called it, all right. Sounds kind of quaint, doesn't it? Like being a doctor of electricity or something. But she was brilliant. I'd never met anyone like her. And she was a real South African, in the best sense of the word. When the Rand dropped so badly, all the other white professors, and even a lot of the Asian and black ones, were sending their CVs off to Europe and America. She just laughed at them. Von Blakes have been here since the 16th century, she always said. We've been here so long you can't pull the roots out. We're not bloody Afrikaners. We're Africans. That's her name, by the way. Susan Von Blake.
If she is your friend, Habu said solemnly, then she will be my friend, too.
You'll like her, I'm sure. God, I haven't seen her in person for a long time. It must be almost 2 years. But when I called her, she just said, come on up, I'll give you lunch. Like I'd been dropping by every other week.
The bus was laboring now, climbing the steep hills into Kloof. The houses, so close together down below, seemed to be a little more snobbish here in the highlands, each keeping a careful distance from its neighbors, surrounding itself with a discreet drapery of trees.
The smartest person I know, Rini said.
There was a car waiting at the bus station, an expensive-looking electric Ilosi. Standing beside it, dressed in immaculate casual clothing, was a tall, middle-aged black man who introduced himself as Jeremiah Dako. He did not say much more before ushering Rini and Habu into the car's back seat. Rini suggested that one of them could ride in the front, but the man's only reply was a chilly smile. After her initial conversational volleys were returned with minimum effort on his part, she gave up and watched the scenery slide by. Uninterested in chit-chat, Jeremiah did seem interested in Habu, or so Rini deduced from his frequent surveillance of the bushman in his rearview mirror. He did not particularly seem to approve of the little man's presence, although what she had seen of Mr. Dacko did not suggest he approved of much of anything. Nevertheless, his covert attention reminded her of her father's reaction. Perhaps this man, too, had believed the bushman to be only an old memory. As they drove through the security gate, the swift way in which Dacko typed in the code and applied thumb to sensor, showing the smoothness of old routine, the house was suddenly visible at the end of the long, tree-lined street, like something out of a dream, tall, clean, welcoming, and just as big as she remembered. Rini had visited Dr. Von Blake at home just a few times long ago, so she was inordinately pleased to find it so familiar. Dacko entered the semicircular driveway and stopped in front of the pillared porch. The effect of its great size was mitigated by the lounger and lawn chairs scattered about on either side of the front door. Susan Von Blake was sitting on one of the chairs reading a book, her white hair bright as a candle flame against the dark background. She looked up as the car stopped, then waved. Rini threw open the car door, earning a sour look from the driver, who had been about to open it. "Don't get up," she cried, then hurried up the steps and hugged her, secretly shocked at how small and bird-like the old woman felt.
"Get up?"
Susan laughed.
"You don't have that much time, do you?"
She pointed to the wheels on her chair, which had been obscured by the tartan blanket bundled over the doctor's knees.
"Oh, my God, what's wrong?"
Rini was a little shocked. Susan Von Blake looked ancient. She had already been in her late 60s when Rini had studied with her, so it wasn't entirely surprising. But it was still unnerving to see what just 2 more years had done.
"Nothing permanent. Well, that's a dangerous thing to say at my age. Broke my hip, basically. All the calcium supplements in the world won't help you if you go down the stairs arse first."
She looked past Rini.
"And this is the friend you said you might bring, yes?"
"Oh, of course. This is Khabu. Khabu, meet Dr. Von Blake."
The little man nodded and smiled gravely as he shook her hand. Dacko, who had reappeared after parking the car off to one side of the driveway, muttered something as he walked past, apparently to himself.
"I'd hoped we could sit outside," said their host, frowning at the sky. "But of course the weather's being bloody."
She lifted a frail hand to gesture at the cavernous porch.
"You know how we Afrikaners are. Always out on the stoop. But it's just too cold. By the way, young man, I hope you're not planning to call me doctor all day. Susan will do nicely."
She pulled off the blanket and handed it to Khabu, who took it as though it were a ceremonial vestment. Then, without using any controls Rini could see, she turned the wheelchair toward the door and up and over a ramp built into the threshold. Rini and Khabu followed her down the broad hallway. The wheels made squeaking sounds on the polished wooden floorboards as the doctor turned and rolled ahead of them into the living room.
"How does the chair work?"
Rini asked. Susan smiled.
"Pretty slick, don't you think? It's quite clever, really. You can get the kind that's controlled directly from a shunt, but that seemed a little severe. After all, I intend to get out of the damn thing eventually. This one just works off skin contact sensors reading my leg muscles. I flex, it goes. At first, it had to be the old-fashioned, manually operated kind, so the bone could heal. But now I can use this as a form of physical therapy. You know, keep the leg muscles in some kind of shape."
She gestured to the couch.
"Please sit down. Jeremiah will bring in some coffee soon."
"I have to admit I was surprised to hear you were still at the university,"
Rini said. Susan pulled a face like an extremely wrinkled child trying spinach for the first time.
"God, what else would I do? Not that I'm in there often. About once a month, really, for something euphemistically called office hours. Mostly I do consultation work right from here, but I do have to get out of this place occasionally. There's only so much solitude I can stand. And, as you may have noticed, Jeremiah isn't the world's most energetic conversationalist."
As if demon-summoned by the sound of his name, Dacko appeared in the doorway, carrying a coffee service and a cafetiere on a tray. He put it down and pressed the plunger. The doctor's appreciation of modern technology apparently did not extend to coffee-making. Then left the room again, but not without another odd and slightly covert look at Khabu. The bushman, who was looking at the doctor's roomful of paintings and sculpture, seemed not to notice.
"He keeps staring,"
Rini said.
All the way up the hill he kept looking at Khabu in the mirror.
Well, it might be that he fancies him, Susan said, smiling. But I suspect it's a bit of a guilty conscience.
Rini shook her head.
What do you mean?
Jeremiah's a Griqua, what they used to call a half-caste in the bad old days, although he's as black as anyone else. A couple of 100 years ago they drove the Bushmen out of this part of southern Africa. Violently, horribly. It was a terrible time. I suppose the whites could have done more to stop it. But the hard truth is they saw more potential in the Griqua than they did in the Bushmen. Those were days when having any white blood at all made you better than someone with none. But still nothing like a white.
She smiled again, rather sadly.
Do your people remember the Griqua with hatred, Khabu? Or are you from a different part of the country entirely?
The little man looked around.
I am sorry. I was not listening carefully to what you were saying.
Susan gazed at him shrewdly.
Ah, you've seen my picture.
He nodded. Rini turned to see what they were talking about. What she had thought was merely the wall screen above the fireplace was actually a photographic print almost 3 meters wide, bigger than any she had seen outside a museum. It showed a painting on a natural rock wall, a primitively simple and graceful work. A gazelle was described in just a few lines, a group of dancing human figures on either side of it. The rock seemed to glow with a sunset light. The paint looked almost fresh, but Rini knew it was not. Khabu was staring at it again. He was holding his shoulders in a strange way, as though something might be stalking him, but his eyes seemed full of wonder rather than fear.
"Do you know where it's from?"
Susan asked him.
"No, but I know it is old, from the days when we Bushmen were the only people in this land."
He reached out a hand as if to touch it, though it was a good 10 feet from the couch on which he sat.
"It is a powerful thing to see,"
he hesitated.
"But I am not certain I am happy to see it in a person's house."
Susan frowned, taking her time.
"Do you mean a white person's house?" "No, it's all right. I understand, or I think I do. I don't mean it to give offense. It does not have religious meaning to me, but I think it's a beautiful thing. I suppose I get spiritual value from it, if that doesn't sound presumptuous."
She stared at the photo as if seeing it anew.
"The painting itself, the original, is still on a cliff face at Giant's Castle in the Drakensberg Mountains. Will it bother you to see it, Khabu? I could ask Jeremiah to take it down. He won't be doing anything else much for the next 2 hours, but he's getting a salary anyway."
The small man shook his head.
"There is no need. When I said I was not comfortable, I was speaking of my own thoughts, my own feelings. Rini knows that I have many worries about my people and their past."
He smiled.
"Their future, too. Perhaps it is better that some people can see it here, at least. Perhaps they will remember, or at least wish they could remember."
They all three drank their coffee for a while in silence, looking at the leaping gazelle and the dancers.
"Well," the doctor said at last, "if you still want to show me something, Irene, we should get to it or we will miss lunch. Jeremiah does not take kindly to alterations in the schedule."
Rini had not explained much on the phone. Now, as she began to tell Susan about the mystery file, she found herself revealing more than she had intended. The doctor, trying to get at the context, asked questions for which it was hard to find partial answers, and Rini soon discovered that she had told her old teacher almost everything except the name of the online club and the reason they had gone there in the first place.
"Old habits die hard,"
Rini thought. Susan was looking at her expectantly, eyes bright, and it was possible to see not only the powerfully impressive woman she had been when Rini had first met her, but the sharp-witted and sharp-tongued girl she had been more than half a century ago.
"I never could lie to her worth a damn."
"But why in the name of God would anyone have a security system like that? What on earth could they be protecting?"
The doctor's intent stare made Rini feel positively delinquent.
"Have you gotten yourself involved with criminals, Irene?"
She suppressed a flinch at the hated name.
"I don't know. I don't really want to talk about it yet. But if they're doing the kinds of things I think they are, then the place should be burned out like a nest of poisonous snakes."
Susan sank back against the cushions of her wheelchair, her face troubled.
"I'll respect your privacy, Irene, but I don't like the sound of this much.
How did you get involved in such a thing? She looked over at Khabu, as though he might be the cause. Rini shrugged.
Let's say that I believe they've got something important to me, and I want it back.
Very well, I give up. I never had the patience for Miss Marplish guessing games. Let's see what you've got. Follow me.
She led Rini and Khabu down the hallway in her silent chair. What looked like an ordinary pair of French doors opened up to reveal a small freight elevator.
Thank God I put this in for moving equipment, said the doctor. Squeeze in tight now. Since this hip nonsense, if I'd only had the stairs, I wouldn't have been able to get down here for months. Well, maybe I could have made Jeremiah carry me. There's a picture.
The basement seemed to cover almost as much space as the house itself. A large part of it was taken up by the lab, which contained several rows of tables in typical laboratory array.
Mess and confusion, was how the doctor put it. I've got a clean standalone system already, and I've finished the antiviral work I was doing with it, she said. We might as well use that. You'd probably just as soon watch this on a monitor screen, wouldn't you?
Rini nodded emphatically. Even with Dr. Von Blake around to help, she wasn't going to put herself in a surround environment to explore whatever gift the Mr. J's folks had sent her. Nobody got to play that trick on her twice.
Okay, then. Fire up your pad and let's go. Load these so I can run some diagnostics before we try to move it onto the new system.
After several minutes, the doctor dropped her squeezers onto her lap robe and made another of her childlike faces.
I can't get into the damn thing. But you're right, it's very strange. Doesn't seem to make much sense as an anti-intrusion device. How are you punishing someone if you Trojan horse something onto their system too big to be activated? Ah, well, you might as well hook up.
Rini connected her pad to the doctor's dedicated machine. Things started to happen very quickly.
It's transferring itself, the same way it downloaded onto my pad in the first place.
But it's not sending a copy. The whole thing is moving.
Susan frowned as she watched the diagnostics flutter through their various calculations. Rini almost felt sorry for all the doctor's specialist programs, as though they were living things, tiny little scientists wringing their hands and arguing with each other as they tried to classify a completely alien object.
I know, Rini said. It doesn't make sense.
She broke off, staring. The monitor screen was beginning to glow more brightly. The diagnostic level disappeared entirely, numbers and symbols and graphs vanishing as though burned away by fire. Something was forming on the screen.
What in the hell is that?
Susan sounded irritated, but there was an edge of real disquiet in her voice.
It's a city.
Rini leaned forward. A slightly hysterical laugh was building inside her. It was like stealing secret microfilm in some old spy flick, and discovering it contained holiday snaps.
It's visual feed of some city.
That's no place I've ever seen.
Susan, too, was leaning forward, as was Khabu, standing behind her chair. The light from the monitor gilded their faces.
Look, have you ever seen cars like that? It's some kind of science fiction clip, some neck flick.
No, it's real.
Rini couldn't say exactly how she knew, but she knew. If it had been a still photograph like Susan's cliff painting, it would have been hard to tell. But movement increased the level of information to the eye and the brain exponentially. Even the best effects people found moving objects harder to synthesize. Rini hadn't been in the VR business as long as Susan, but she had as good an eye as anybody, and better than most. Even in Mr. J's, with the top-of-the-line machinery they clearly had at their command, she had been able to spot subtle failures of coordination and naturalistic movement. But this city of golden towers, of rippling banners and elevated trains, had no such flaws.
I think I have seen this somewhere, said Khabu. It is like a dream.
Susan picked up her squeezers and made a few gestures.
It's just running on automatic. I can't find any information attached to it.
She frowned.
I'll just...
The picture vanished. For a moment, the entire monitor went dark. Then the screen came back up in a blizzard of flickering pixels.
What did you do?
Rini had to look away. The juddering, sparkling light reminded her of the last unpleasant hour in the club.
Nothing. The damn thing just turned itself off.
Susan restarted the system, which came back up as if everything were normal.
It's gone.
Turned itself off?
Gone. Gone.
There's no trace of it at all.
10 minutes later, Susan dropped her squeezers again and rolled her chair back from the monitor. She had searched both her own computer and Reenie's pad diligently, with no result.
"My eyes hurt," she said. "Do you want to go at it?"
"I can't think of anything you haven't done. How could it just disappear?"
"Some kind of autophage. Played, then ate itself. Nothing left now."
"So all we had was some picture of a city." Reenie was depressed. "We don't know why. And now we don't even have that."
"Ah, of course. I almost forgot."
Susan pulled her chair back close to the screen.
"I was taking a display sample when the thing went kerplunk. Let's see what we got."
She directed the machine's search. A few moments later, the screen resolved into a gauzy golden abstract.
"We got it."
The doctor squinted.
"Cock. It was just losing resolution when I got the snapshot. My eyes aren't so good on close-up work, Irene. Can you see anything in it at all? Or is it just random colored pixels?"
"I think so."
"There is a tower," Khabu said slowly. "There. Right. Then we'll need to move it onto the main system. Since I took the sample myself, we'll assume it's inert, and therefore safe. Although this whole thing has been strange enough to make me less than completely confident about anything. Ah, well."
She had a quick talk with the household wiring. A few minutes later, they were again staring at the golden smear, now stretched yards wide across the laboratory wall screen.
"I have some image enhancement gear that might help," she said. "Some of the preliminary stages can work through while we have lunch. Clean up the signal noise, rewind the deresolution sequence as much as possible. Come along. Jeremiah's probably having a fit."
"Khabu?"
Reenie put her hand on his shoulder. The bushman seemed entranced by the wall screen image.
"Are you okay?"
"This way, even distorted so, it still seems familiar to me."
He stared at the shapeless swirls of amber, gold, and creamy yellow.
"I have seen this somewhere, but it is not a memory so much as a feeling."
Reenie shrugged.
"I don't know what to say. Let's go have lunch. Maybe it will come to you."
He followed her almost reluctantly, stopping one last time in the elevator doorway to look back. His brow wrinkled in perplexity. Susan had been right. Jeremiah was more than a little offended when the doctor and her guests trooped in 20 minutes late for lunch. "I did not poach the fish until I heard you coming," he said accusingly, "but I cannot promise anything about the vegetables." In fact, the vegetables had survived very nicely, and the sea bass was tender and flaky. Reenie could not remember when she had eaten such a nice meal, and she took pains to tell Doc Oso. His good humor slightly restored, the man nodded as he cleared the dishes. "Dr. Von Blake would rather have sandwiches every day," he said. "An art dealer asked for paintings on black velvet." Susan laughed.
"I just never want to have to come upstairs and sit down when I'm working. The days when I don't work through lunch and sometimes dinner are the days I'm feeling my age. You don't want me to be old, do you, Jeremiah?"
"The doctor is not old," he said. "The doctor is stubborn and self-centered."
He withdrew to the kitchen.
"Poor man."
Susan shook her head.
"He came to work for us when my husband was still alive. We used to have parties then, people from the university, foreign visitors. It was a more fulfilling household to run, I'm sure. But he's right. He doesn't see me most days after breakfast, unless there's some correspondence I have to sign. He leaves bitter little notes about all the things he's done that I haven't noticed. They make me laugh, I'm afraid."
Khabu had been watching Jeremiah with careful interest.
"He is like my mother's brother, I think. A proud man who could do more than he is asked to do. It is not good for the spirit."
Susan pursed her lips. Reenie thought the doctor might be offended.
"Perhaps you are right," she said at last. "I have not set Jeremiah many challenges lately. I have rather drawn in on myself. But maybe that has been selfish of me."
She turned to Reenie.
"He came to us at a time when things were still very unsettled, of course. He had been very poorly educated. You do not know how lucky you are, Irene. The school system was already much better by the time you came along. But I think Jeremiah would have done well in any number of things, given the opportunity. He is an extremely quick learner, and very thorough."
The doctor looked down at her hands, at the silver spoon held in her gnarled fingers.
"I had hoped his generation would be the last to grow up damaged by what we did.
Rini could not help thinking of her own father, floundering in an ocean invisible to everyone else, unable to find solid ground on which to stand.
I'll think about what you said, Khabu.
Susan put down her fork and briskly wiped her hands.
It is possible to get too set in one's ways. Anyway, let's go see what we can do with our mystery city.
The imaging programs had restored the snapshot to something like a recognizable picture. The substance of the city was now visible as a garden of fuzzy vertical oblongs and triangles, with impressionist smears representing the roads and elevated rails. Rini and the doctor began to correct small areas, adding detail from their own memory that augmented the general patterns imposed by the enhancement gear. Khabu proved particularly helpful. His visual memory was excellent. Where Rini and Susan might remember that there had been windows in the flat plane of a wall, Khabu could often tell them how many there had been and which had been illuminated. After more than an hour, a picture had taken shape that was recognizably the golden city which had burned on the screen for a few brief moments. It was less sharply defined, and there were areas in which the reconstruction was largely guesswork, but anyone who had seen such a place would recognize this as an image of it.
So now we start searching.
Susan tilted her head to one side.
Although it's still not quite right somehow.
It doesn't look real anymore, said Rini. It's lost that alive quality. Of course it has. It's a flat, unmoving, totally rebuilt version. But that was part of the effect of the original. It was like looking through a hole in the computer at a real city.
I suppose you're right. Still, it's the strangest damn place I've ever seen. If it's real, it must be one of those prefab fibramic monstrosities they spring up overnight in the Indonesian archipelago, or somewhere like that.
She rubbed at her knees.
These damn sensors are starting to chafe my legs. I'm afraid I'm going to have to call it a day, my dear. But I'll start searching for a good match off the specialist nets. You're not back at work yet, are you? Then you might as well let me do it. I've got at least 3 contracts I could charge it off to. Multinationals with million human-hour datacomb projects who'd never notice a little extra connection time. And I've got a friend, well, an acquaintance, named Martine de Ruban, who's an absolute top-flight researcher. I'll see if she has anything to offer. Maybe Martine will even pitch in a little free help, since it's for a good cause.
She looked at Rini, that shrewd, searching gaze again.
It is for a good cause, isn't it? This is something very important to you.
Rini could only nod.
Right then, on your way. I'll call you if I get any hits.
Dako met them outside the elevator on the main floor. As if by magic, he had the car waiting at the front door. Rini hugged Dr. Von Blake and pressed a kiss against her powdered cheek.
Thank you. It's been wonderful to see you.
Susan smiled.
You didn't have to wait until you were being chased by VR terrorists to come visit me, you know.
I know. Thank you so much.
Khabu shook the doctor's hand. She held on to him for a few moments, her eyes bright.
It's been a pleasure to meet you. I hope you will come again.
I would like that very much.
Good. It's settled.
She rolled her chair onto the porch as they climbed into the car, then waved to them from the shadows of the porch as Dako swung around the long driveway and out onto the tree-lined road.
You look very sad.
Khabu had been staring at her for a long, uncomfortable time.
Not sad, just frustrated. Every time I think I might be getting somewhere with this, I run into a brick wall.
You should not say I, but we.
His liquid brown eyes rebuked her. But Rini could not even find the strength to feel guilty.
You've helped me a lot, Khabu. Of course you have.
I am not speaking of me, but of you. You are not alone. Look, today we have spoken to that wise woman, your friend, and she will certainly help us. There is strength in companionship, in family.
Khabu spread his hands.
We are all of us small when set against the great powers, against the thunder or the sandstorm.
This is more than a sandstorm.
Rini fumbled reflexively for a cigarette, then remembered she couldn't smoke on the bus.
If I'm not completely crazy, this is bigger and stranger than anything I've ever heard of.
But that is just the time when you must call on those who will help you. In my family, we say, I wish baboons were on this rock, except that we call them the people who sit on their heels.
Call who?
The baboons. I was taught that all the creatures who live beneath the sun are people, like us, but different. It is not a familiar way to think among city folk, I know. But to my family, especially my father's family, all living things are people. The baboons are the people that sit on their heels. Surely you have seen them and know it is so. Rini nodded, a little ashamed that she had only seen baboons caged in the Durban Zoo.
But why did you say you wished there were baboons on a rock?
It means that it is a time of great necessity, and we need help. Usually, my people and the people who sit on their heels were not friends. In fact, long ago the baboons committed a great crime against our grandfather Mantis. There was a great war between his people and theirs.
Rini could not help smiling. He spoke of these mythical beings, monkeys and mantises, as casually as if they were fellow students at the Poly.
A war?
Yes. It came of a long argument. Mantis was fearful that things would turn sour, so to be prepared, he sent one of his sons to gather sticks to make arrows. The baboons saw this boy carefully choosing and gathering the wood, and asked him what he was doing.
Khabu shook his head.
Young Mantis was foolishly innocent. He told them that his father was preparing to make war against the people who sat on their heels. The baboons were enraged and fearful. They became more and more agitated, arguing among themselves. Then, at last, they fell upon young Mantis and killed him. Then, made bold by their easy victory, they took his eye and played with it, throwing it back and forth between them as though it were a ball, crying, "I want it! Whose turn is it?" over and over again as they fought for it. Old Grandfather Mantis heard his son crying out to him in a dream. He took his bow and ran so fast to the place that even the few arrows he carried rattled like wind in a thorn bush. He fought the baboons, and though he was far outnumbered, he managed to take from them his son's eye. Although he was badly wounded himself, he put it in his skin bag and fled. He took the eye to a place where water rose from the ground and reeds grew, and he put the eye in the water, telling it to grow once more. Many days he returned to find nothing had changed, but still he did not stop. Then one day he heard splashing and found his child made whole again, swimming in the water.
Khabu grinned, enjoying the happy moment. Then his expression sobered.
That was the first battle in the war between the baboons and the mantis people. It was a long and terrible fight, and both sides suffered many losses before it ended.
But I don't understand. If that's the story, why would you say you want baboons to help you? They sound terrible.
Ah, but they were only that way because they were frightened, thinking that Grandfather Mantis intended to make war on them. But the real reason we asked the baboons to help is an old story of my father's family. I fear I am talking too much, though.
He looked at her from beneath his eyelashes with, Rini thought, a certain sly humor.
No, please, she said.
Anything was preferable to dwelling on her own failures as the bleak gray city rolled past the windows.
Tell me,
it happened long ago. So long that I'm sure you would believe it to be a myth.
He gave her a look that was mockingly stern.
I was told that the woman involved was my grandmother's grandmother's grandmother. In any case, a woman of my family, whose name was Anuka, became separated from her people. There had been a drought, and all the people had to go in different directions, all to search the farthest sipping holes. She and her husband went one direction, he carrying their last water in an ostrich egg, she carrying their young child upon her hip. They walked far, but did not find water at the first or the second hole they tried. They moved on, but had to stop because of the darkness, thirsty and hungry as well, for during a drought, of course, game is hard to find. They lay down to sleep. Anuka cradled her child close, singing so that he might forget the pains in his stomach. She awoke. The slivered moon, which inspired men of the early race to make the first bow, was high overhead, but it gave little light. Her husband sat upright beside her, his eyes wide and frightened. A voice spoke from the darkness beyond the last smoldering coals of their fire. They could see nothing but two eyes, gleaming like cold, distant stars. "I see three of you, two large, one small," the voice said. "Give me the small one, for I am hungry, and I will let the other two go." Anuka held her child close. "Who is that?" she cried. "Who is there?" But the voice only repeated what it said before. "We will not do that," her husband cried. "And if you come near to our fire, I will shoot you with a poisoned arrow, and your blood will turn sour in your veins, and you will die. Then I would be foolish to come to your fire," the voice said. "But I am patient. You are far from your people, and you must sleep sometime." The eyes winked out. Anuka and her husband were very frightened. "I know who that is," she said. "That is Hyena, the worst of the old ones. He will follow us until we fall asleep. Then he will kill us and devour our child. Then I will fight him now, before weariness and thirst take all my strength away," said her husband. "But it may be my day to die, for Hyena is clever, and his jaws are strong. I will go out to fight him, but you must run away with our child." Nuka argued with him, but he would not change his mind. He sang a song to the morning star, the greatest of all hunters, then went out into the darkness. Anuka wept as she carried their child away. She heard a coughing bark. Chuff, chuff, chuff! Khabu jutted his chin forward to make the noise. And then her husband cried out. After that, she heard nothing. She ran and ran, urging her child to be silent. After a while, she heard a voice calling from behind her. I see two of you, one large and one small. Give me the small one, for I am hungry, and I will let the other one go. She had a great fear then, for she knew that old Hyena had killed her husband, and that soon he would catch her as well and kill both her and her child, and there were none of her people anywhere close that could help her. She was alone in that night. Khabu's voice had taken on a strange cadence, as though the original tale in its original words struggled to make itself heard through the unfamiliar English tongue. Rini, who had been wondering a little uncomfortably whether her friend actually believed the story was true, suddenly had a kind of revelation. It was a story. No more, no less. And stories were the things people used to give the universe a shape. In that, she realized, Khabu was exactly right. There was little difference between a folk tale, a religious revelation, and a scientific theory. It was an unsettling and oddly liberating concept, and for a moment she lost the track of Khabu's tale. Rising before her from the sand, three times her height, she climbed this stone, holding her child close against her breasts. She could hear Hyena's breathing, louder and louder, and when she looked back she could see his great yellow eyes in the darkness, growing larger and larger. She sang again, Grandfather Mantis, help me now, Grandfather Star, help me now, send me strength to climb. She climbed until she was out of Hyena's reach, and then huddled in a crack in the rock as he walked back and forth below. Soon you will be hungry. Soon you will be thirsty, Hyena called up to her. Soon your child will be hungry and thirsty too, and will cry for sweet milk and water. Soon the hot sun will rise. The rock is bare, and nothing grows upon it. What will you do when your stomach begins to ache, when your tongue cracks like the mud cracks? Anuka felt a great fear then, for everything that old Hyena said was true. She began to weep, crying, Here is where I have come to the ending. Here is where no one is my friend, and my family is far away. She heard old Hyena singing to himself below, settled in to wait. Then a voice said to her, What are you doing here on our rock? A person came down from the top of the rock, and it was one of the people who sit on their heels. In old times my family's people had been at war with the baboons, so Anuka was afraid. Do not hurt me, she said. Old Hyena has driven me here. He has killed my husband, and he waits below to kill me and my child. This person looked at her, and when he spoke he was angry. Why do you say this to us? Why do you ask us not to hurt you? Have we ever offered you harm? Anuka bowed her head. Your people and my people were enemies once. You fought a war with Grandfather Mantis, and I have never offered you friendship. Because you are not a friend does not make you an enemy, said the baboon. And Hyena down below is an enemy to both of us. Come up to the top of the rock where the rest of my people are. Anuka climbed up behind him. When she got to the top of the rock, she saw that all the baboons were wearing headdresses of badger hair and ostrich plumes, for they were having a celebration feast. They gave food to her and her child, and when everyone was full, one of the oldest and wisest of the people who sit on their heels spoke to her, saying, Now we must talk together, thinking of what we may do about old Hyena, for just as you are trapped upon this rock, so are we, and now we have eaten all the food and drunk all the water. They talked and talked for a long time, and the hyena down below became impatient and shouted up to them, "I smell the people who sit on their heels, and them too I will bite and crack their bones in my jaws. Come down and give me the smallest, tenderest one, and I will let the rest of you go." The old baboon turned to Anuka and said, "There is a red flame that your people can summon. Summon it now, for if you can, there may be something we can do." Anuka took out her fire starter and bent down low so the wind would not blow away the spark. And when she had made the red flames come, she and the baboons took a piece of stone from the great rock and put it in the fire. When it was hot, Anuka wrapped it in a piece of hide that the old baboon gave her. Then she went to the edge of the rock and called down to old Hyena, "I am going to throw you down, my child, because I am hungry and thirsty, and the rock is bare." "Good, throw him down," Hyena said. "I am hungry too." Anuka leaned out and threw down the hot stone. Old Hyena leaped on it and swallowed it, hide and all. When it was inside his belly, it began to burn him, and he called out to the clouds, begging them to send rain. But no rain came. He rolled on the ground, trying to make himself vomit it up again. But while he was doing this, Anuka and the baboons came down from the rock and picked up more stones and killed Hyena with them. Anuka thanked the people who sit on their heels, and the oldest of those people said to her, "Remember that when the greater enemy was before us both, we were your friends." She swore that she would, and from that day, when danger or confusion is upon my family, we say, "I wish baboons were on this rock."
Rini left Khabu in the Pinetown bus station with scarcely time to say goodbye, since her local was about to pull out. As the bus rolled down the ramp onto the busy rush-hour street, she watched the small young man standing beneath the overhang, scanning the schedule board, and again felt a rush of guilt.
"He believes that baboons are going to come and help him. Jesus mercy, what have I dragged him into?"
For that matter, what had she gotten herself into? She seemed to have made some very powerful enemies, and for all that she had almost died, she had very little idea of what might be going on, and even less proof.
Make that no proof. Well, a blurry snapshot of a city. One copy on my pad, one on Susan's system. Try that with UNCOM. Yes, we think these people are murdering the minds of children. Our evidence? This picture of a lot of tall buildings.
There were quite a lot of people out on the streets around her neighborhood in the lowlands of Pinetown. She was a little surprised since it was a weeknight, but the people on the sidewalk definitely exhibited something of a carnival air, standing in knots in the center of the road, calling out to acquaintances, passing cans of beer around. When she dismounted the bus at the bottom of the hill, she could even smell smoke hanging sharp in the air, as though someone had been letting off fireworks. It was only when she had made her way halfway up Ubusika Street and saw the lights of emergency vehicles flaring and dying against the side of the flat block tower, the cloud of camera drones hovering like flies in front of the flames, that she finally understood. She was breathless and sweating when she reached the police cordon. A thick pall of smoke was funneling upward from the flat block roof, a dark finger against the evening sky. Several of the windows on her floor were smashed and blackened as if by intense heat exploding outward. Rini's stomach contracted in fear when she saw that one of them was hers. She counted again, hoping she had been wrong, but knowing she hadn't. A young black trooper in a visor held her back as she pressed against the temporary barrier, begging to be let through. When she told him she was a resident, he directed her to a mobile trailer at the far side of the parking lot. At least 100 people from the flat block, and 2 or 3 times that number of people from the surrounding area, were milling around in the street. But Rini didn't see her father among them. Suddenly, she was trying desperately to remember what he'd said he was going to do that day. Usually he was home by late afternoon. There was too much of a crush around the trailer to talk to anyone official. Dozens of voices were baying for attention, most desperate for news of loved ones. Some just wanting to know what had happened or whether there would be insurance compensation. Rini was pushed and jostled until she thought she would scream from frustration and fear. When she realized that no one would notice if she did scream, she fought her way back out of the crowd, her eyes blurred with tears.
Ms. Sulawayo?
Mr. Prakash, the small, round Asian man who lived down the hall, took his hand from her arm as if surprised at himself. He was wearing pajamas and a bathrobe, but had pulled a pair of unlaced takis onto his feet.
This is terrible, is it not?
Have you seen my father?
He shook his head.
No, I have not seen him. It is too confusing here. My wife and daughter are somewhere here because they came out with me, but I have not seen them since.
What happened?
An explosion, I think.
We were eating our meal, then foom!
He clapped his hands together.
Before we knew what had occurred, there were people in the hallway shouting. I do not know what has caused it.
He shrugged nervously, as though he might somehow be held responsible.
Did you see the helicopters? Many of them came, dumping foam on the roof and spraying it on the outside walls. I am sure it will make us all very sick.
Rini pulled away from him. She could not share in his alarmed but somehow excited mood. His family was safe, doubtless gossiping with other neighbors. Had everyone survived? Surely not, with damage of the sort she could see. Where was her father? She felt cold all over. So many times she had wanted him gone, wished him and his bad temper out of her life, but she had never thought it might come to this. 7:30 in the evening, the street full of chattering voyeurs and shell-shocked casualties. Things didn't happen this suddenly, did they? She stopped short, staring at the blackened row of windows. Could it have been her? Had something she'd done inspired a reprisal from the people at Mr. J's? Rini shook her head, feeling dizzy. Surely that was paranoia. An old heater, faulty wiring, someone using a cheap stove. There were any number of things that could cause this, and all of them far more likely than the murderous vengeance of the owners of a VR club. A murmur of thrilled horror went through the crowd. The firefighters were bringing stretchers out of the front door. Rini was terrified, but could not simply wait for news. She tried to push back through the knot of onlookers, but passage was impossible. Squirming, applying an elbow when necessary, she worked her way out to the edge of the crowd, meaning to circle around and try to get near the front door from the other side of the cordon. He was sitting on a curb beside an unoccupied police van, his head in his hands.
Papa? Papa!
She dropped to her knees and threw her arms around him. He looked up slowly, as though not sure what was happening. He smelled pungently of beer, but at the moment she didn't care.
Rainy? Girl, that you?
He stared at her for a moment, his reddened eyes so intent that she thought he might hit her. Instead, he burst into tears and wrapped his arms around her shoulders, pushing his face against her neck, hugging her so close she was almost throttled.
Oh, girl, I feel so bad. I shouldn't have done it. I thought you were inside there. Ah, God, Rini, I feel so bad. I'm so ashamed.
Papa, what are you talking about? What did you do?
You were going out for the day. See your teacher friend.
He shook his head, but would not meet her eyes.
Walter come by. He said, let's just go out and have a little time. But I drank too much. I came back. This whole place burned up here, and I thought you were back and got burned up, too.
He swallowed air, struggling.
I am so ashamed.
Oh, Papa, I'm okay. I just got back. I was worried about you.
He took a deep, shuddering breath.
I saw the fire, burning the place up. Jesus, save me, girl. I thought about your poor mother. I thought I lost you, too.
Rini was crying now as well. It was a while until she could bear to let him go. They sat side by side on the curb, watching the last of the flames slowly wink out as the firefighters finished their job.
Everything, said Long Joseph. All Stephen's toys, the wall screen, everything. I don't know what we're gonna do, girl.
Right now I think we need to go find some coffee.
She stood up, then stretched out her hand. Her father took it and got to his feet, shaky and unstable.
Coffee?
He stared at what had been their home. The flat block looked like the site of a fierce battle that nobody had won.
I guess so,
he said.
Why not?
Chapter 16. The Deadly Tower of Senbar Flay. Netfeed News. Death of child called nanotech murder. Visual. School picture of Garza. V.O. Lawyers representing the family of fire victim Desdemona Garza called the lack of government oversight of chemical companies
A License to Commit Nanotech Murder.
Visual, Children in Clothing Store.
Garza, age 7, died when her Activex, trademark, jacket caught fire. Her family maintains that the fatal fire was caused by the fabric's faulty nano-engineering.
The lanterns of the thieves' quarter were dim and widely separated, as though a few glowing fish swam in the vast pool of night that drowned the criminal district of ancient Madrikor. The city heralds, who never descended into the quarter, called the hour from the safety of the curtain wall. Hearing their cry, Thargor the swordsman stared sullenly at his cup of mead. He did not look up at the sound of quiet footsteps, but his muscles tensed. His runesword Life Reaper's oiled length rested lightly in the scabbard, ready to leap forth at an instant's notice to deal death to anyone so foolish as to try a treacherous attack on the scourge of the Middle Country.
Thargor? Is that you?
It was his sometime companion, Pithlit, shrouded in a gray traveling robe to keep out the evening chill, and to hide his identity as well. The little bandit had dabbled too many times in the complicated politics of the Thieves' Guild, and currently was not entirely welcome in the quarter.
Yes, it's me. Damn, what took you so long? I was detained by other business. A dangerous commission.
Pithlit did not sound very convincing.
But now I have come. Pray tell me our destination.
Another 10 minutes and I'd have left without you. Thargor snorted, then rose to his feet.
Let's go. And for God's sake, quit talking like that. This isn't a game anymore. And we go to the house of the wizard Senbar Flay?
Fredericks had not quite readjusted to normal speech.
Damn right. He was the one who sent me into the tomb in the first place, and I want to know why.
Orlando fought down his impatience. He would have preferred to jump directly to Flay's fortress, but the Middle Country Sim World was rigorous about distances and travel times. Unless you had a transportation spell to burn or a magic steed, you went at RL pace. Just because he no longer wanted to slog through the game's normal complications didn't mean he could change the rules. At least his horse was the Middle Country's top-of-the-line model.
But how can you be here at all?
Frederick's voice had a worried edge.
You got killed. I mean, Thargor did.
Yeah, but I decided to file a request for review after all.
But Table of Judgment won't be able to find what I saw. That whole section of the game record is just gone.
So the city will stay a secret.
But if they don't find it, they'll just confirm Thargor's death.
Frederick's spurred his horse forward. It had been dropping steadily behind Orlando's swifter Blackwind.
The table will never overrule on your word alone. I know, Scan Boy, but while they're reviewing, Thargor is alive until proven dead, and I can get around the Middle Country a lot faster and learn a lot more as him than if I had to start over as Wee Willie Winkle, the midget mercenary or something.
Oh, Fredericks thought about this for a moment.
Hey, that's major crafty, Gardino. Kind of like getting out on bail so you can prove you're innocent, like that Johnny Icepick flick.
Kind of. The city was quiet tonight. Or at least the streets were. Which was not surprising, considering that it was time for end-of-semester exams in most places. Madrikor, some journalist had once commented, was a bit like a Florida beach town. The population rose and fell with school vacations, peaking during summer, spring break, and Christmas. The New Year's Eve party in Madrikor's King Galathiel Square was not a great deal different than any end-of-season drunken orgy in Lauderdale, the writer had pointed out, except that in Florida, fewer people had bat wings or carried battle axes. They rode out of the thieves' quarter and down the cobbled street of small gods. Orlando deliberately made a wide detour around the Palace of Shadows. The POS people were not real gamers, as far as he was concerned. They never seemed to do anything. They just hung around together and had parties, pretended to be vampires or demons, and did a lot of soft sex and other things that they thought were decadent. Orlando thought they were basically pretty embarrassing. But if you wandered into their turf, you had to go through all kinds of bullshit to get out again. They had established ownership of their little piece of Madrikor early in the history of Middle Country, and inside the Palace of Shadows, as well as in a few other private houses in the city, they made the rules and enforced them. Fredericks had taken him to a POS party once. Orlando had spent most of it trying not to stare at what people were doing, mostly because he knew they really wanted to be stared at, and he didn't want to give them the satisfaction. He had met a fairly nice girl in a living dead sim, tattered shroud, pale rotting skin, and deep sunken eyes, and they had talked for a while.
She had an English accent, but she lived on Gibraltar, off the coast of Spain, and wanted to visit America. She said she thought suicide could be an art form, which he thought was pretty stupid, but otherwise he had enjoyed talking to her, even though she had never heard of Thargor, and in fact had never been anywhere in the Middle Country outside the Palace of Shadows. But nothing came of it, of course, although she acted like she would have liked to meet him again. After a couple of hours, he had left and gone to the Garot and Dirk in the quarter to swap lies with other adventurers. Lights were burning in the tallest tower of the Palace of Shadows, as Orlando and Fredericks turned down Blind Beggar's Lane toward the river. Probably having one of their stupid initiations, he decided. He tried to remember the living dead girl's name. Maria? Martina? But couldn't. He wondered if he might bump into her again sometime. Probably not unless he went back to the palace, which effectively meant never. Senbar Flay's house was built on a jetty that stretched halfway out into the silver dark river. It crouched above the murky water like a gargoyle, silent but watchful. Fredericks reined up and stared at it. It was hard to see his pifflet face on the dark embankment, but he didn't sound happy.
"You've been here before, haven't you?"
"Once, sort of."
"What does that mean?"
"He magicked me directly inside. He was hiring me for a job, remember?"
"So you don't know anything about his defenses? Hey, Gardner, you may be dead, but I'm not. I don't want to get Piflet killed off for nothing."
Orlando scowled. It was hard to resist drawing Life Reaper and brandishing it, the kind of thing he normally did when someone got fluttery in the middle of a dangerous quest. But Fredericks was coming along as a favor, after all.
"Look," he said as calmly as he could. "I've knocked off places that make this look like a coat closet. Just hold your water."
Fredericks scowled back.
"Do you even have a plan? Or are you just going to pound your way in with your thick head? Gossip around the quarter says he's got a watch griffin. You can't kill one of those things with anything short of nuclear weapons, Monsieur le Scanmaster."
Orlando grinned. His bad temper washed away by the familiar bickering and the pleasure of doing what he did best.
"Yeah, they're tough, but they're stupid. Come on, Fredericks. What kind of thief are you, anyway?"
Things went smoothly enough at first. At Orlando's request, Fredericks had brought along a counteragent to the poisonous flowers in the wizard's garden, and the four men-at-arms dicing in the gazebo had proved no match for barbarian Thargor's athletic runesword-swinging technique. The stone walls of the wizard's tower were smooth as glass, but Orlando, who had survived the most rigorous schooling and adventure that the Middle Country could offer, always carried plenty of rope. He flung a grappling hook over the fourth-floor railing, and soon was standing on the balcony's mosaic floor, helping Fredericks climb over.
"Couldn't you just have asked him why he sent you to that tomb?"
The thief was wheezing very convincingly. Orlando guessed that Fredericks' parents must have come through with a higher-quality implant he had coveted for his birthday.
"Oh, Fen-Fen, Fredericks, use your brain. If this was some kind of plot to get Thargor killed, I'm sure he'd tell me. Why should he be in on some plot? You don't even know who Senbar Flay is."
"I don't think I know. But even if I don't know him, that still doesn't mean anything. Thargor's pissed off a lot of people." Fredericks, or rather Piflet, straightened up from breath-recovering position.
"Thargor's pissing me off,"
he began, but was interrupted by the abrupt appearance of a very large watch griffin. The great beak glimmered in the moonlight. Its tail lashed from side to side as it padded across the balcony, moving with the relaxed but steady tread of a cat heading toward a full supper bowl.
"Thargor, where the beast?"
squeaked Fredericks, reverting to old habits under stress. Then, remembering,
"It's a red one, the expensive kind, not affected by magical weapons."
"It would be a red one," Orlando said sourly. He drew Life Reaper and dropped into a defensive crouch. The griffin stopped, its posture still deceptively casual. If anything about a lion-eagle mixture 8 feet tall at the shoulder could be termed casual, and regarded them both with glassy, emotionless black eyes before it settled on tall Thargor as the one to be dealt with first. Orlando was disgusted. He had hoped it would at least make an initial move toward Fredericks, which would give him one clean shot at its ribcage. The creature twisted its neck to look at him sideways, since its aquiline head allowed it only very limited binocular vision. Orlando seized the opportunity and moved until he was directly in front of its beak again, then leaped forward, aiming for the throat.
The griffin had better vision than he'd have wished, or better reflexes. It reared at his attack, and swung a massive taloned paw. Orlando dove, rolling beneath the terrible claws, took a two-handed grip on Life Reaper, and jabbed as hard as he could into the beast's vitals. The sword clanked against scales and was turned aside. God damn! He scrambled back under the paws again, just before the vast bulk could drop down and trap him. The frigging thing might as well be wearing chainmail. The rope! Shouted Fredericks. Head for the rope! Orlando raised his sword again and began circling the griffin. The creature's deep, rumbling growl sounded almost amused as it pivoted on its hindquarters, watching him. Now, I'm going to get inside this place. Fredericks was jumping up and down beside the railing. Damn it, Orlando! If you get killed again while you're on probation, you'll never get back into the game. Then I guess I'd better not get killed. Now shut up and do something useful. He flung himself to one side as the griffin snatched at him again. The powerful claws snagged for a moment in his cloak and scored his side. Orlando was as good as anybody in the sim world at making conversation while fighting for his life. But there was a good reason he'd adopted Thargor's laconic barbarian style. Snappy repartee was for court duelists, not monster fighters. Monsters didn't get distracted by chatter. The red griffin was slowly backing him toward the balcony railing, hurting him with slashing nails and darting beak. Another few steps and he'd have nowhere to go. Orlando! The rope! He darted a glance over his shoulder. Escape was indeed only an arm's reach away. But if he gave up, then what? He could live without Thargor. Work his way back up with another character, despite the dreadful loss of all the time he'd put in. But if he admitted defeat, he might never learn anything more about the Golden City. No gaming alter ego, not even one as much a part of him as Thargor, would ever haunt his dreams the way that wild vision had. Fredericks, he shouted, grab the rope and wrap it tight around the railing. Now! It'll hold the way it is! Orlando cursed and danced back. The great red thing lunged forward another step, staying out of reach of Life Reaper. Just do it! Fredericks worked frantically at the railing. Orlando swiped at the thing's eyes to distract it, but instead bounced his blade ringingly off its beak. Its head-darting counterattack almost took off his arm. I did it! Now pull up the rest of it and throw it over the thing's neck. Right over, like I was standing on the other side waiting for it, instead of staring right up its nose. He fended off another sweep from a huge scarlet paw. Fredericks started to protest, but instead hauled up the rope and flung it across the creature's shoulders in a loose coil. Startled, the griffin raised its head. But the rope just snaked over the top of its mane and tumbled down onto the tiles a few yards from Thargor's left hand. Now do something to distract it. Like what? Damn it, Fredericks! Tell it some knock-knock jokes, anything! The thief bent and picked up a clay pot that stood near the railing, heaved it up over his head, then flung it at the griffin. It smashed against the creature's ponderous ribcage. The griffin hissed and darted its head to the side as though snapping at a flea. In the moment of its inattention, Orlando jumped to his left and grabbed the coil of rope, then threw himself at the creature's neck just as it was turning back toward him. The beak scythed down. He sprawled onto the ground, still clutching the rope, and tumbled and crawled beneath the griffin's neck. As he emerged from the other side, the beast growled its displeasure at this irritatingly swift-moving enemy. Before it could turn far enough to get at him, Orlando dropped Life Reaper to the tiles and sprang onto the griffin's shoulder, grasping at the mane of blood-red bristles to pull himself up to bareback riding position. He dug his heels into its broad neck and yanked back on the rope as hard as he could, tightening it around the creature's throat. "I hope it doesn't think of rolling over on me," was the last coherent thought he had for some moments. The great worm of Morsen Keep had been long and strong and slippery, and its death battle against Thargor had possessed the added attraction of taking place underneath 3 fathoms of dirty water. Even Orlando, connoisseur of the game world, had been impressed by the realism of the experience. Given the time to reflect now, he would have been similarly awed by the excellent way the griffin's designers had managed to foresee his own somewhat dubious strategy, and had managed to program in a quite inspiring simulation of what it must feel like to simultaneously ride and strangle 2 tons of supernatural fury on the hoof. Fredericks was a shouting blur. The entire balcony was little more than a vibrating smear.
The thing beneath him was both frenetic in its movements and stone hard. He felt like he was trying to wrestle an angry cement mixer. End of side 9. To continue, turn the cassette over. Side 10. City of Golden Shadow. Otherland, Volume 1. By Tad Williams. Continuing on page 295. Orlando leaned in as close as he could, hugging the griffin's neck even as he held the rope tight. He was in the one place its claws and beak could not reach, but the thing was doing its best to see he wouldn't stay there long. Every jerk, every convulsive shake almost knocked him from his perch. The griffin's thunderous growl did not sound amused anymore, but neither did it sound like it was suffocating. Orlando wondered briefly if red griffins, besides being immune to supernatural weapons, might not also breathe in some unusual way. Just my luck. It bucked again. He realized it was only a matter of moments until its frantic struggling would dislodge him. For consistency's sake, Orlando said the prayer Thargor would have said as he took one hand off the rope and reached down to his boot, searching for his dagger. He tightened his legs around the creature's neck, wrapped his fingers more firmly around the rope, then gauged his moment and drove the knife into the griffin's eye. The rumbling snarl ripped upward into a screech. Orlando found himself flying through the air in a most convincing way. As he struck and rolled, the vast scarlet bulk of the griffin toppled toward him, fountaining black blood.
"Zang, man! Ho-Zang! Utterly chiz! That was one of your best ever!"
Orlando sat up. Fredericks stood next to him, his pifflet face wide-eyed with excitement.
"Thank God I don't use regular tactors," he said, then groaned as Fredericks helped him up. "But I still wish I'd turned off the feedback. That hurt."
"But you wouldn't get credit for the kill if you did that."
Orlando sighed and looked at the griffin. Dead, it seemed to take up even more room than before, sprawling across the tiles like an upended bus.
"Frigging hell, Frederico, I got other things to worry about. I just want to get into that tower. If Thargor is going to be declared dead, what does another notch mean? Career statistics. You know, like an athlete or something. Jesus, you really scan. Come on."
Orlando picked Life Reaper out of the spreading puddle of dark blood, then wiped it on the corpse's hide before heading confidently toward the door at the back of the balcony. If there had been any more guards lurking, the commotion would surely have brought them by now. The balcony opened onto the base of a wide stairway, composed of writhing human forms. In the light from the wall sconces, he could see a row of mouths opening and shutting along the banister. The murmur of their complaining voices filled the room. He would have been more impressed if he hadn't seen an advertisement for the tortured souls overlay in a gaming magazine a few weeks before. He curled his lip.
"Typical wizard."
Fredericks nodded. The stairs led up past several more floors, all full of snap-on wizard gear, much of it familiar, and most of it fairly low rent. Orlando decided that Senbar Flay, whoever he was, had shot most of his allowance on the griffin. Shame about that, he thought. Maybe it was insured. He didn't bother to search any of the lower rooms. Wizard types, like cats, always opted for the highest perches, as if they had to look down on everyone else. Other than a squadron of large but somewhat sluggish guard spiders, which Orlando easily dispersed with a few strokes from Life Reaper, they encountered no further opposition. In the topmost part of the tower, in a great circular room with windows that overlooked Madricor in all directions, they found Senbar Flay, asleep.
"He's not home," said Fredericks, half relieved.
The body was stretched out on a jet-black bier, and surrounded by something that would have looked like a glass box if it had been a bit more substantial.
"Got wards around his body, too."
Orlando examined the wizard's inert sim. Senbar Flay was as heavily robed as he had been at their first meeting, everything but his lidded eyes wrapped in metallic black fabric. He wore a goblin skull helmet. Although Orlando had real doubts the sorcerer had killed the goblin himself, the markets of Madricor's Merchant Row were full of such things, harvested by local adventurers and sold so they could improve their weaponry, their attributes, or buy a little extra online time. Adding a more exotic touch to the ensemble, the wizard's hands were gloved in human flesh. But from the puckered stitching, it did not appear to be his own.
Glory Hands, noted Fredericks. I saw him in this shop in Lambda. Give you power over the dead, I think. What are you going to do, Orlando? He's not here. I knew he wasn't here when the Griffin didn't bring him out, but this guy sent me down that hole, and something weird happened to me there. I want answers. He reached into his pocket and brought out a small black circle the size of a poker chip. And I'm gonna get 'em. What's that? Wizards aren't the only people who can do magic. Orlando dropped the circle onto the floor, then crouched and pulled at its edges until it looked like a manhole the size of a dinner plate. Beazle, come here! The shambling something with too many legs clambered up out of the black circle.
Keep your shirt on, boss, it growled. I'm here already.
What are you doing? Fredericks was so shocked that Orlando almost laughed. His friend sounded like an old lady.
You can't hack that thing in here. No unregistered agents allowed in the Middle Country.
I can do anything if I can make the gear work, but you'll be banned forever. Not just Thargor, you. Only if somebody tells. And who would do that? He fixed Fredericks with a stern look. Now do you see why I'm not going to register that kill?
But what if someone checks the record?
Orlando sighed for the second time in 15 minutes. These arguments with Fredericks could go on for days. Beazel, pull this note apart. Get me every piece of local information you can, but concentrate on communications in and out.
Will do.
The cartoon bug dropped back down into the hole, and immediately the air filled with a ruckus of chainsaws and clawhammers. Orlando turned back to his friend. No one's going to check the record unless Senbar Flay asks them to, and he won't do that if he's got something to hide.
And if he doesn't have anything to hide,
then I'll have to apologize, won't I? Or at least buy him a new Griffin. Orlando pulled open the data window until it blocked his view of Frederick's frowning face. He opaqued the background, just to make sure no disapproval leaked through, and studied the glowing characters Beazel was pumping out. His name's Sasha Diller. Never heard of him. You?
No.
Fredericks sounded distinctly sullen. Perhaps thinking of the potential damage to his own Middle Country franchise if this affair came to the attention of the Table of Judgment. Registered in Palm Beach Inner. Huh. I would have thought a rich kid would do better than this. Everything except the Watch Griffin is strictly House of Gear. He let his eyes rove down the window. 12th level. Like I couldn't guess. Calls in and out? Hardly any. A couple of codes here I don't recognize. He hasn't been around much lately. Orlando pointed at a section of the window, which reconfigured. He grunted in surprise.
What?
He's been around exactly twice in the last 6 months. 2 days in a row. The second was the one where he gave me the commission.
That's weird.
Fredericks looked down at Senbar Flay's uninhabited body.
Why don't you just pump out the data you want? We should get out of here.
Orlando smiled. He knew his sim wasn't showing much of it. Thargor didn't smile very well.
Some thief you are. Is this how you act when you're on one of your little jobs? Like a kid sneaking down to rattle his Christmas presents? Pithlid doesn't break the rules of the Middle Country.
Frederick's dignity was wounded.
He's not scared of anything, much. But I'm worried about getting banned for life.
Okay. It's going to be a long time before this guy comes back anyway, by the looks of it. Orlando began to close the window, then stopped, arrested by something he'd seen, and enlarged it again. He stared for a long while, long enough to make his friend start to shuffle nervously, then shut it and sent the information to his home system.
What? What was it?
Nothing. Orlando looked down at the hole.
Beazel, you done?
As if to be contrary, the agent appeared from the general area of the ceiling, dangling on a very cartoony-looking rope that Orlando knew was not part of the wizard's tower decor.
Depends what you mean by done, boss. How fine you want the information sifted? You got all the big stuff already.
Long years of interaction had taught Orlando to translate Beazel's seeming informality. He was probably now tracing the provenance of every piece of Snap-on software in the place.
The big stuff will do. Do a backgrounder on the Griffin, though.
A good one. Beazel spun at the end of his rope for a moment.
Done.
Then let's get out of here. Hit that rope and start climbing down, Federico.
Climbing? Why don't we just go?
Because I'm not leaving the way you are. You go the long way.
Keep an eye open and make sure we didn't leave any obvious traces. You know, club keys from the Thieves' Quarter Lounge, stuff like that.
Very funny. What are you going to do?
Trust me. You don't want to know.
Orlando gave Fredericks a decent head start. Then, when he felt sure his friend should be shinnying down the rope, Fredericks had spent lots of points on rope shinnying ability, so Orlando figured he wouldn't be at it too long. He summoned Beazel back.
What now, boss? We going somewhere interesting?
Only home. But first, I want you to do something. Can we leave a little data bomb behind?
A grinning mouth appeared in the inky mop of legs.
We are having fun today. What you want to do exactly?
I can't do anything to the central record, and I certainly can't make a seamless edit like someone did to me, even in this guy's house file. But I can make sure that whoever comes in here next won't know who was here or what happened. Not unless they've got table of judgment authority.
Your call, boss. But I can scorch it good, yeah. Complete scramble.
Orlando hesitated. He was taking a big risk. Bigger even than Fredericks knew. This had become so important to him so quickly, and he was basing it all on one look at Beazel's data. But he hadn't become Thargor, Scourge of the Middle Country, by being afraid to go for broke.
Scorch it. You did what?
Pulled it down. Not from the outside. No one will be able to tell unless they actually get into the place.
Fredericks, back in one of his bodybuilder sims, leaped out of his chair so quickly that he flew into the air and caromed off the cottage wall. Orlando adjusted the gravity, and his friend floated down and bumped to rest beside the pyramid of display cases.
Are you scanned utterly?
Fredericks shouted.
That's not just the Middle Country death penalty, and maybe thrown off the whole net. That's criminal prosecution, too. You destroyed someone's property.
Don't get your fen-fen in an uproar. That's why I sent you out first. You're in the clear.
Fredericks raised his chunky fists, his sim face, slightly less realistic than Piflet's, which probably indicated something profound, although Orlando couldn't say what exactly, screwed up in fury.
I don't care about me. Well, that's not true. But what the hell is going on with you, Gardner? Just because Thargor's dead, you're trying to get yourself thrown off the net. What are you, some kind of martyr?
Orlando settled back into his virtual couch, smiling.
You sound like my mother.
His friend's cold anger was fierce and surprising.
Don't say that! Don't you dare say that!
Sorry, just spanking you. Look, I'll let you in on something. Beazel, run that information out for me again, will you?
The window appeared and hung gleaming in midair like an angelic visitation.
Now orb this.
Orlando boxed and expanded a small section.
Go on. Read it.
Fredericks squinted.
It's a shutdown order.
He straightened up, a little relief evident in his voice.
Cinbar Flay's tower is going to be taken down? But it still doesn't make sense, Gardner, what you did. If they're going to dress it anyway...
You didn't finish reading. Look at who told the Middle Country Gaming Board to shut it down.
Some judge in Palm Beach County, Florida?
And the date, 6 months ago. And it's only been used twice since that time.
Fredericks shook his head.
I don't get it.
This guy Diller's dead. Or in jail or something. Anyway, he ceased to be the operator pretty much 6 months ago. But for some reason it hasn't been dressed. And, more importantly, someone's used it. Used Diller's sim, even. Used it to hire me.
Wow. Barking. Are you sure?
I'm not sure of anything. But Beazel's checking for me. You got anything yet, Beazel?
The agent popped out of a crack in the wall beside the picture window.
Got the Diller stuff. Still working on the watch, Griffin.
Give me what you've got so far. Just tell me.
Diller. Seth Emanuel. You want dates and everything?
Just summarize. I'll stop you if I want more data.
He's a coma case. Date of shutdown coincides with the date of a trustee being named for his estate. 13 years old at last birthday. Parents dead. Grandmother applied for legal aid. She started a lawsuit against Middle Country, plus the hardware manufacturers, primarily Critipong Electronic and subsidiaries.
Orlando pondered. So he had enough money to have good equipment, but the grandmother doesn't have enough money to sue?
Beazel waved his legs for a moment.
All the hardware and gear named in the lawsuit's at least 4 years old. Some much older.
You want me to get the grandmother's finances? Diller, Judith Ruskin. Nah.
He turned to Fredericks, who was sitting forward, beginning to believe.
This guy's in a coma, as good as dead. His estate wants his online stuff shut down, probably to save money. And his grandma's suing the Middle Country, too. But it doesn't shut down. And someone else uses it, at least 2 times. His equipment was nice once, but it's old now. And his grandmother doesn't have any money. But there's a top-of-the-line, utterly scorching red griffin on the site to keep people out. How much you want to bet it was purchased after this Diller kid checked out?
I'm working on the griffin, boss, said Beazle. But it ain't easy.
Keep trying.
He put his feet up on nothing.
What do you think now, Frederico?
His friend, who had seemed quite excited only a few moments ago, now grew strangely still, as though he had left his sim entirely.
I don't know, he said at last. This is getting weird, Orlando. Really Scanbark. How could someone keep a note open in the Middle Country when the people who run it wanted it shut down?
I'll bet that somebody fiddled the central records. We only know because the shutdown order was registered on the note itself when the judge made her decision. But if someone went in and adjusted the central records, the automatic dres would never happen. You know the system's too big for anyone to notice, at least until the case comes to court and the whole thing gets dragged out again.
But that's what I mean. You're talking about someone hacking the Middle Country Central Records.
Orlando made a noise of annoyance.
Fredericks, we already knew they could do that. Look at what happened to me down in that tomb. They just took the whole sequence out and then sewed it back up again, like they were surgeons.
But why?
Don't know.
Orlando turned to examine his MBC window, watching the constructor robots patiently excavating the red Martian soil was soothing, like watching cows in a field. He needed to slow his excited thoughts.
I just know I'm right.
Fredericks got up, a little more carefully this time, and walked to the center of the room.
But Orlando, it isn't Morpher or Dieter. This isn't just someone trying to get over on us. These people are like criminals. And why are they messing with things, taking all these risks, just to show you some city? It doesn't make sense.
Not much.
Sifting, digging, then sifting some more, the constructor robots went on about their tasks. They were just on the other side of an imaginary window, and simultaneously millions of miles away. Orlando tried to remember the time lag of the transmission, but couldn't. Not that what they were doing at this exact moment probably looked any different from this delayed version he was looking at, and the mindless things would continue, working and working, dying off and being replaced from their own self-created factory. In another few years, the project would end. A tiny blister of plastic would hug the Martian surface, a place where a few hundred humans could shelter against the harshness of an alien world.
Orlando?
His friend's voice tugged him back to the equally alien world of his virtual house. Frederick's broad-shouldered sim had crossed its arms as though to hold something inside its barrel-like chest.
Gardino, old man, this scares me.
Orlando sat up, pillows bunched behind him, his blanket wrapped around his thin legs as tightly as a cold beggar's robe, and listened to nothing. He knew from books that houses had not always been like this. He suspected that most houses in other parts of the world, and even lots of them here in America, were not like this even now. He knew that in many places boards creaked, and upstairs neighbors thumped, and people talked on the other side of walls. He had visited a friend from the medical center once, a boy named Tim, whose parents lived in a house on a street with nothing separating them from the rest of the city. Even during the day, you could hear cars moaning past on the freeway half a mile distant. On nights like this, when his father had stopped snoring for a bit, Orlando couldn't hear anything at all. His mother always slept like a dead person. The gardeners had no pets except for a few dozen exotic fish, but fish were quiet animals, and all the systems that supported life in their tank were noiselessly chemical. The building's human residents were cared for no less discreetly. Machinery in the house's walls adjusted temperatures, monitored air quality, random tested the circuitry on lights and alarm systems, but all in silence. Outside, an army might be trooping past beyond the heavy walls and insulated windows of their house.
But as long as no one stepped in front of a sensor beam, Orlando would never know. There was something to be said for the kind of safety and security money could buy. Orlando's mother and father could go shopping, attend the theater, walk the dog, if they'd had one, all without leaving the vast security estate that was Crown Heights. His mother claimed they had only done it for Orlando's sake. A child like him should not be subjected to the dangers of city life, they had decided, but equally clearly should not be raised in some rural place, a long car or helicopter ride away from modern conveniences. But since most of his parents' friends also lived either in Crown Heights or in similar fortified mid-city security townships, they were called exclusive communities in the ads, and didn't have his parents' excuse for it, he wondered if she was telling him the truth. Sometimes he wondered if she even knew the truth herself. The house was silent. Orlando was lonely and a little unsettled. His fingers found the link cable by his bedside. He thought for a moment about going to the net, but he knew what would happen if his mother got up to pee or something while he was oblivious and saw him plugged in. She was on an anti-net campaign as it was, although what else she expected him to do she'd never made clear. If she caught him, he might lose the privilege, as she termed it, for weeks. He didn't dare risk it just now, not with all the things that were happening. Beazle? There was no response. He had spoken too softly, apparently. He crawled to the foot of the bed and leaned over. Beazle? Voice activation was a bitch when you were worried about waking up your parents. A minute hum wafted out of the darkness. A small, dim light brightened. Then seven more tiny red lights blinked on in circular sequence until he could see a small, scarlet ring gleaming in the shadows near his closet door.
Yes, boss?
Quieter, like me. Beazle matched his volume level.
Yes, boss?
Anything to tell me?
A few things. Some of them strange. I was going to wait until morning.
The conversation was still making Orlando nervous. His mother had been on a bulk scorch lately about not sleeping, and sometimes the woman had ears as sharp as a bat's, even in her sleep. He was sure it was some kind of mother thing, a latent genetic abnormality that only emerged after giving birth, and lasted until you'd driven your children out of the house. He briefly considered doing the whole thing silently on screen, but at least if his mother woke up and heard him talking, he could pretend it had been in his sleep. If she caught him with a glowing screen, it would be harder to explain away. Besides, he was lonely, and having someone to talk to was still the best cure for that.
Bug, come over here so we don't have to talk so loud.
A couple of near-silent clicks indicated that Beazle was detaching his robot body from the power outlet, where it had been quietly sucking nourishment like a flea on a dog's back. The ring of red lights slid down the wall and then came across the carpet at about shoe-top height. Orlando scrambled back to his pillows and got under the blankets again, so he could enjoy the ticklishly amusing sensation of Beazle clambering up the bedclothes. He enjoyed it mostly because he was not so grown up as to have forgotten the slightly creepy way it had felt when he was a little boy. Beazle approached the pillow, humming and clicking as faintly as a cricket wrapped in a yard of cotton. He crawled onto Orlando's shoulder and adjusted for stability, rubber-tipped feet scrabbling to get a satisfactory grip. Orlando wondered if someday Beazles, or things like Beazle, would be able to move as freely in RL as they did in the virtual world. He had already seen news stories about agents with robotic bodies going feral because of bad programming or aging software, escaping their owners to live like woodlice in the infrastructures of buildings. What would such things want out of life? Did they run away on purpose, or just lose the ability to follow their original programming and wander off into freedom? Did they retain vestiges of their original artificial personality? Beazle had settled with his speaker beside Orlando's ear, and now spoke so quietly as to be barely audible.
Better?
That's fine. So tell me what you have.
Which first?
The Griffin.
Well, first off, we don't know for sure when it was purchased, but everything else lines up with your guess. It was first introduced into the node after the shutdown order.
So Diller didn't buy it.
Well, a call on the hospital databank says he's still there, and still listed as comatose. So even if he bought it, he sure didn't install it.
Where's it from? Beazle readjusted in response to Orlando's small change of position. His Brooklyn cab driver accent continued to purr into his master's ear.
That's one of the strange things. It doesn't correspond exactly to anything. It's been customized from several different chunks of code. I think it did more than just perform its middle country duties. But it's too late now to go back and check those possibilities. Maybe if you go back in, boss.
I doubt it. So you can't find out who bought it or who made it?
The chain of manufacture is messed up all to hell. I can't trace an unbroken line. Companies have gone out of business. Trademarks on some parts of it are held under what seem to be invented names. Not in any indexes I can find anywhere.
If an agent in a robot body could sigh, Beazle would have sighed.
It's been hell, I'm telling you. But one thing keeps coming up.
Which is?
Treehouse.
At first, Orlando thought he had misheard Beazle's whisper.
You mean the place?
Most of the invented names are hacker tags, and a lot of them show up in treehouse-related material.
Wow. Let me think. Beazle sat patiently. Unlike his parents or Frederick's, you could tell Beazle to do something, and he'd do it. He knew let me think meant don't talk, and if Orlando didn't prompt him to speak again, the robot would crouch silently in place until he had to crawl back to his socket to recharge. Orlando needed a few moments of quiet. He didn't quite know what to say. If this trail he seemed to be following led toward Treehouse, that was both exciting and extremely daunting. Exciting because Treehouse, often called the last free place on the net, was supposed to be an anarchistic hacker's paradise, an outlaw node that floated through the system like an illegal street-corner craps game. Net gossip said that it was supported not by massive corporate structures like the other big nodes, but by an ever-changing network of its residents' own small systems. It was supposed to be like a gypsy camp. The whole thing could be taken down in minutes, stored as small and widely distributed individual chunks, then fitted back together again equally swiftly. The daunting aspect was that nobody just went to Treehouse. It was pretty much invitation only, and since it had no commercial purpose, and was in fact by its own governing principles opposed to being useful in any meaningful way, those who found it usually wanted only to enjoy and help preserve its exclusivity. So you couldn't just go to Treehouse like you could to some other node. Being told that the answers to his questions might be discovered there was like telling a medieval peasant that he could find something in Cathay or Samarkand. For a teenager with no connections, if it wasn't actually mythical, it was still so unreachable as to be in effect purely imaginary. Treehouse. Excitement moved inside him, but something else fought for room beside it, something he knew very well, although he had never before felt it about something on the net. Just like Frederick's, he was scared. Beazle, he said at last, are you sure?
Boss, please.
Beazle was old equipment, but he was an impressive piece of work. There was nothing artificial about his tone of scorn. Then get me everything you can on Treehouse. No, not everything. At least at first you'd better just give me stuff with a reasonable believability weight. Information with multiple sources. We can decide whether we want to start hunting through the really scanny stuff later.
Even so, boss, it's gonna take a while.
I'll take whatever you've got in the morning. He remembered that tomorrow was an appointment day. No, after lunch. I'll look at it, then decide.
If you want a really thorough search by tomorrow, I'd better lose this body and get to it. Crawling around wastes an awful lot of bandwidth, you know.
Orlando made a face. One problem with hanging on to your childhood agent was that they tended to lecture you. Tell me something new. Go on, get out of here. The rubber-clad metal polyps riffled in sequence as Beazle backed away from his ear.
Good night, boss.
Night, Beazle. The agent made its laborious way down the blankets to the floor. Like cats, bugs found it easier to climb up than down. Orlando watched the faint gleam of red until it reached the wall outlet once more, socketed in, and turned off its display. Treehouse. It was so strange to think of that name in connection with something he, Orlando Gardner, was going to do. It was like deciding you were really going to fly to Never Neverland, or go down a rabbit hole to look for Alice's friends. But it made sense in a weird way. If people existed who could hack into a system as sophisticated as the Middle Country, excise an entire 5 minutes, or whatever it had been, then leave no trace, not only of who had done it, but that anything had even been done, they would be the kind of people who hung around in Treehouse. He sank down into the pillows. But he knew sleep would not come soon. There was so much to think about. Had he really found something unusual? Something worth causing all this trouble over? Something worth taking so many risks? Or was it only that the vision of the strange city made him think about things he'd stopped considering? Fredericks would tell him he was getting carried away. Certainly, data bombing someone's node was not a normal kind of thing to do. His parents would be horrified. A sudden thought made his neck go prickly. Orlando sat up. The idea was too uncomfortable to consider lying down. He had figured that only someone with access to the Middle Country records would ever know he had been in Cenbar Flay's tower. He had even said so to Fredericks. But clearly, whoever had snipped out the sequence in the tomb and managed to suppress a shutdown order for half a year could walk in and out of the Table of Judgment's master files at will, and do things to them that even their owners couldn't do. If that was the case, then whoever had rigged the whole thing in the first place could find out about Thargor's visit any time he or she wanted to, and the mystery hacker could find out about Thargor's creator with even greater ease. Sour bile rose to Orlando's mouth, with the kind of stupid self-confidence that would make any imaginary barbarian proud. He had as good as told this person of near limitless skills and an obvious desire for secrecy that there was a 14-year-old kid looking for him. Surely the whole thing was just the work of some extremely talented, slightly childish prankster. But if the city and the records fixing were indicative of something bigger, something far more illegal, he could only hope that his adversary had a really good sense of humor. "Yoo-hoo, Mr. Big League Computer Criminal. It's me, Orlando Gardner. Drop by any time. I won't put up much of a fight." Hell, all someone would have to do was fiddle his medical records. The wrong dermal patch, and it would be Sayonara Irene. Treehouse. An image out of childhood. A place to escape the real world of grown-ups and rules. But who else liked to lurk beyond the edge of the playground? Out of reach of authority. Bullies. Serious troublemakers. Bad guys. Eyes wide open, Orlando sat in the dark and listened to nothing. Chapter 17. A Call from Jeremiah. Netfeed. Sports. Caribbean Youth signs guinea pig contract. Visual. Bando playing dirt court basketball game. V.O. Solomon Bando, a 12-year-old Dominican boy, will become the first child to receive hormone treatments paid for and administered by a professional sports franchise. Bando's family signed a contract with the Ensenada Anvac Clippers of the World Basketball Association that permits their son, chosen as an optimum specimen from several hundred applicants, to undergo a series of bodybuilding hormone treatments and bone grafts designed to help him reach an adult height of at least 7.5 feet. Visual. Roland Crinzy, Clippers Vice President. Crinzy, we're building for the future, not just taking the short view. Our fans appreciate that. Rini fumbled with her packages, trying to juggle them into some kind of manageable arrangement. The bus wheezed and rolled slowly away on underinflated tires, off to deposit a few more souls on a few more corners, like a strange animal marking the circuit of its territory. The day had turned even hotter while she had been on the bus, although the sun was well down toward the horizon. She could feel sweat trickling down the back of her neck and along her spine. Before the fire, her stop had been only a few streets from her flat, although that had always seemed a terrible trudge at the end of a working day. Only 2 weeks later, she was beginning to look back on the old days with nostalgic fondness. The streets of Lower Pinetown were full, as they usually were this time of the day. People of all ages lounged in doorways or on front steps, gossiping with neighbors next door or even across the street, shouting something scurrilous so everyone who could hear was part of the fun. In the middle of the road, a group of young men were playing football, the contest watched closely by a pack of children who ran up and down the sidewalks as the progress of the match shifted from one end of the street to the other, and more casually by the audience on the stoops. Most of the players wore only shorts and battered takis. As she watched their perspiration-slicked bodies move, listened to them laughing and shouting, Rini felt a deep, hollow craving for someone to hold her and love her. Waste of time, girl. Too much to do. One of the young men in the match, lean and shaven-headed, looked something like her old boyfriend, Del Rey. Even had a little of his insolent grace. For a moment he was there in the street in front of her. Even though she knew the boy who had captured her attention was years younger, she wondered what the real Del Rey was doing, where he was at this very moment. She hadn't thought of him in a while, and wasn't sure she was happy to be reminded. Had he gone to Johannesburg, as he had always sworn he would? Surely nothing could have kept him from going into government and making his way up the ladder of respect. Del Rey had been very ambitious. Or was he still here in Durban, perhaps returning home from work to a waiting woman? To his wife, maybe. It had been at least 5 years since she'd seen him. Time enough for anything to have happened. He might have children. For all she knew, he might be dead. She shivered a little and realized she had stopped in the middle of the sidewalk. The young man, who now raced ahead of the entire pack, dribbling the scuffed ball, flew past her. She saw a flash of gold in his grin of exertion. He didn't really look much like Del Rey. A group of small children swept past her like an ocean wave, following the young man who wasn't her old boyfriend as he hurtled toward the goal. She had to cling to her packages as the shrieking troops whirled by. Then she began walking again. A few hundred yards took her past the stoops and into the small and rather depressing shopping district. A dress in a window caught her eye. She slowed. The pale fabric had a strange sheen, and the slanting sunlight seemed to move across it unevenly. It was odd, but somehow striking, and she stopped to look more closely. It had been a long time since she'd bought herself any clothes that weren't practical. She shook her head with a small sense of triumphant martyrdom. If there was ever a time when she needed to save her money, when she couldn't afford something just because it would make her feel nice, now was that time. A movement in or behind the reflection caught her eye as she turned back to the sidewalk. For a moment she thought it was someone in the shop window. But when she moved to a different angle, she could see the window was empty but for mannequins. Something had moved quite close behind her. She whirled, but saw only a bit of dark clothing disappearing down a side street a dozen yards away. Just the other side, walking away from Rini on the sidewalk, two young women were looking back over their shoulders with faintly puzzled expressions, as though watching whoever it might have been. Rini readjusted her bag and walked a little more purposefully. It was not as if it were after dark, or she were the only person on the street. A small crowd stood in front of the corner market just 100 steps ahead, and there were at least a half dozen people closer to her than that. She might well be in some kind of trouble, but it was dangerous to start believing that people were following you. As she waited to cross the street, she casually turned and looked back. A rangy man in a dark shirt and metal-framed sunglasses was staring fixedly into the dress shop window. He did not meet her eyes, or show any sign that he even knew she existed, but she still felt a kind of attention emanating from him. Perhaps she was jumping at shadows. Then again, that was what they called it when somebody followed somebody, wasn't it? Shadowing? It's dangerous to believe that people are following you, but maybe it's dangerous to disbelieve it, too. She went into the market on the corner, even though she had already done her shopping near the Poly, where the better stores were. When she came out with a soft drink in her hand, there was no sign of the man in the dark shirt. The shelter had been a truck depot, and it still retained its former sense of intimacy and warmth. The 12-meter-high ceilings gaped in places where the cheap corrugated fibramic didn't quite meet. The floor was concrete, still blackened in places with ancient oil stains. The Greater Durban Social Welfare Department had done what it could, mostly with volunteer labor. The huge space had been hived with fiberboard partitions across which curtains could be hung, and a wide, carpeted common area in one corner held a wall screen, a large gas fire, dart boards, and an old billiards table. But the building had been converted hastily in the wake of the flooding 3 years before, and hadn't been modified since. At the time, it had been meant only as temporary housing for those displaced from the lower townships. But after the overspill had receded, the local government had kept the building. They hired it out, between the fairly infrequent emergencies, for dances and political rallies, although it had a core population that had never found other homes. Keeping the shelter had not meant being able to improve it, though. Leenie wrinkled her nose as she walked across the open area near the front door. How could a place that was so drafty in cold weather hold in the heat and stink so effectively during the summer? She dumped the packages in the 4x3-meter booth, which was their temporary home. Her father wasn't there, but she had not expected him to be. She pulled the tab on a cigarette, kicked off her shoes, then pulled the curtain closed so she could take off her work clothes and keep them relatively clean. When she had changed into shorts and a loose-fitting shirt, she put the groceries in the tiny refrigerator, set the kettle on the hot plate, stubbed her cigarette, and went off to search for Long Joseph. He was over by the wall screen with the usual bunch of men, some his age, some younger. They were watching a football match being played on green grass somewhere, a contest between well-paid professionals in one of the commercial sports ground Neverlands that only existed on broadcasts. She couldn't help thinking about the real game in the street only a short distance away. What brought the young men in out of the sunshine and turned them into the only slightly older ones here? Slow of speech, but quick to argue. Shallow swimming. Content to sit and nurse a few beers through a long afternoon in a steamy warehouse. How could men start out so strong, so vital, and then turn so sour? Her father looked up at her approach, and in guilty reflex attempted to hide his beer. She ignored it. "I'm making some coffee, Papa. Then we have to go see Stephen." He sneaked a quick look down at the bottle held against his leg. It was almost empty. The other men were watching the screen intently. Leenie had heard a colleague say that men were like dogs. If so, it was never more apparent than when they watched the movement of a ball. Long Joseph swallowed the last mouthful, then put it down on the concrete with a defiant flourish. "I'll come. Got to see the boy." As they walked back across the broad expanse, Leenie thought she saw the man in the dark shirt again, this time silhouetted in the front doorway. But it was hard to be certain with the light streaming in from behind him. She pushed down a surge of unease. Even if it were him, that didn't mean anything. There were almost 500 people living in the shelter, and many more who just came in during the day to hang around. She knew only the few dozen other refugees from their burned flat block. She looked again when the light wasn't in her eyes, but couldn't see him anymore. "It used to be good," her father said suddenly. "Every day. Good to do it."
"What?"
"When I was working. When I was an electrician. Finish up, put down the tools, stop with my friends to have a drink. Good to be finished. But then my back got hurt."
Leenie said nothing.
Her father's back injury had occurred, or at least he claimed it had occurred, in the year after the death of her Uma Bongela, her grandmother, who had been the children's caretaker after their mother's death in the store fire. Long Joseph's injury had also coincided with his much greater interest in drinking, and in his coming back so late from his social evenings that Leenie had usually taken her baby brother into bed with her to quiet his crying. She had always had her doubts about his back injury. Unless he had been bowed down so long by hard work piled on hard work, and then by the added almost impossible burden of losing wife and mother-in-law and being left as sole parent to two young children, that he had just reached a point where he could not straighten up anymore. That, too, could be called a back injury of sorts.
"You could still do it, you know."
"What?" He was distracted, staring out into the middle distance as he walked.
"Be an electrician. God knows there are lots of people with problems around here. I bet they'd love to have you help them."
He gave her a quick, angry look before staring ahead again. "My back."
"Just don't do anything that will make it worse. I'm sure there are lots of other things you could do. Half the people in this building have their power outlets overloaded. Old wires, bad appliances. You could go around and have a look."
"Goddamn girl, if you want to get rid of me, just say it to me."
He was suddenly furious,
his hands clenched into fists. "I'm not going around begging people for jobs, trying to tell me my monthly payment isn't enough."
"No, Papa."
In his early 50s, he was becoming a querulous old man. She wanted to touch him, but didn't dare.
"No, Papa. It was just an idea. I'd just like to see you..."
"Make myself useful? I'm useful to me, girl. Now you mind your own business." They walked in silence back to their space. Long Joseph sat down on the bed and conducted a long, critical examination of his slippers, while Leenie made two cups of instant coffee. When the tablets had finished effervescing, she passed one to her father.
"Can I ask you something else? Or are you going to be in a bad mood all evening?"
He looked at her over the rim of his cup. What?
What did the man look like in front of our flat block? Remember? The one you saw waiting in the car that night when Khabu came over?
He shrugged and blew on his coffee. How do I know? It was dark. He had a beard, a hat. Why do you want to know that?
The man shadowing her had been beardless,
but that proved nothing. Anyone could shave.
I'm worried, Papa. I think there might be someone following me. He scowled.
What nonsense is this? Following you? Who?
I don't know, but I think I may have upset somebody. I've been looking into what happened to Stephen, doing some research on my own.
Long Joseph shook his head, still frowning. What kind of silliness you talking, girl? Who following you, a crazy doctor?
No. She wrapped her hands around her own